Well, a few weeks ago, we looked at the words translated bold in the New Testament. We examined the examples of Jesus and the apostles in the early church with respect to boldness. We saw that New Testament Christians were indeed bold and confident in their Savior, and as members of the family, they were bold to share the family news with others. We saw that we too are to be bold and confident with the gospel. We saw all that. But you remember when we started the sermon, I read from Ecclesiastes, and I'll just read those verses again. We know we're very familiar with the verses that talk about there's a time and a place for everything, time for every purpose under the heaven, it says in Ecclesiastes 3, verse 1. And then in verse 7, there's a time to rend, a time to sow, a time to keep silence, and a time to speak. And we read that before and realized that there's different, different times to be different ways. How should we apply this in the context of boldness? Is there a time, perhaps, that we shouldn't be quite so bold or come across that way? Jesus was certainly bold and confident, but did he have another side? That's what I want to look at today. In fact, if you'll turn to Isaiah chapter 42, this is the basis for the sermon, a few verses in Isaiah chapter 42. I'll read them. Isaiah 42, I'll begin in verse 1, read to verse 4. Isaiah 42, verse 1. Behold my servant, whom I uphold, mine elect, in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He shall bring forth judgment to the Gentiles. He will not cry, nor lift up, nor cause his voice to be heard in the street. A bruised reed, this is from the King James, a bruised reed shall he not break, and the smoking flax he will not quench. He shall bring forth judgment unto truth. He will not fail nor be discouraged till he has set judgment in the earth, and the isles shall wait for his law. This is a prophecy of the Messiah. It's recognized as such. And it says that a bruised reed he will not break, and a smoking flax he will not quench. So what I'd like to do today is to look at this prophecy in detail, see what some of these words mean, paint a more exact word picture, and then spend a little time in the Gospels, specifically Matthew, to see how it was fulfilled. And then, before we're through, we'll apply Jesus' example to ourselves a little bit and see how his example instructs us. If you like titles, if you want to put a title on the tape or on your notes or wherever, we could call this one Be Gentle. Be Gentle. Reminds me of our dogs, unfortunately. This just occurred to me. The dogs are getting old. I used to be able to feed them and they wouldn't bite your hand off, and they're getting less gentle for some reason. I don't know. You go to give them a little piece of meat or something like that and they like to bite your fingers off, and we're constantly reminding them to be gentle. So maybe there's a lesson there. I need to remind myself to be gentle as well. In Isaiah 42, it says, he will not cry nor lift up nor cause, this is verse 2, cause his voice to be heard in the street. A bruised reed shall he not break, and a smoking flax shall he not quench. He will bring forth judgment with truth. Let's turn to Matthew chapter 12. Not an obvious place to turn because this is quoted in Matthew 12. And Matthew, in response to certain things that were going on, quoted these verses in Isaiah. What I'll do is let's just read through the beginning of Matthew 12 to set the stage, to see what was going on in Jesus' life and in the life of the apostles when Matthew felt it was a good time to quote Isaiah 42. In Matthew chapter 12, this was the Sabbath, and everything that happened in Matthew 12, I believe in 13, all happened within about a day. This was on the Sabbath morning, apparently. They went through verse 1, Matthew 12, verse 1. They went through the grain field there, and the disciples were hungry and began to pluck ears of corn and eat, and there was nothing illegal about that. Hungry people were allowed, under the Jewish law, the law from the Old Testament, to pick a crop from a field to feed themselves just as they were traveling. Well, the Pharisees saw that, and they had a problem with it because it was Sabbath. So instead of them thinking that they were just feeding themselves because they were hungry, it got to be they had rules against harvesting on the Sabbath. That's work. So the Pharisees had their rules, and they caused a problem here for Jesus and confronted him about this. Without going into the details of that, there was nothing wrong, and Jesus explained it. But verse 7 says, but if you had known what this means, I will have mercy and not sacrifice, you wouldn't have condemned the guiltless. He was pointing out that these people are so worried about the ifs, ands, the buts, the jots and the tittles, the you know, all of these rules and regulations, that they miss the point of the law. That certainly God doesn't intend for somebody to go hungry because it's somehow work to pluck an apple off a tree up there where I live in Adams County. It doesn't make any sense. The law never intended that kind of a restrictive interpretation of the Sabbath. Verse 9. Then, of course, he departed. He went into their synagogue, and there was somebody who was a cripple there. His hand was withered in verse 10. And they were tempting him. They're trying to get him in trouble. And they want to know if it's lawful to heal him on the Sabbath day. And he answered them with a lot of information, which, again, I won't go through. But in verse 13, he says he's told him to stretch forth his hand. And he stretched it forth, and it was restored whole like the other. The Pharisees went out, verse 14, and held a council against him how they might destroy him. They were furious. He was popular. He was helping people. People were flocking to him. And he was just mocking them in a way, because they're trying to trap him, and he heals somebody, and everybody rejoices, and it makes them look terrible. So they're out to get him. They're out to destroy him. Notice what verse 15 says. It says, when he knew it, he withdrew himself from there, and great multitudes followed him, and he healed them all. He actually left. There was a confrontation brewing, and it wasn't his time, and he got away from it. He left. He charged those that he had healed. It says he healed them all in verse 15. He charged them that they should not make him known. And this is what reminded Matthew of the prophecy. That it might be fulfilled which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, behold my servant whom I have chosen, my beloved, in whom my soul is well pleased. This part was quoted back when Jesus was baptized. I will put my spirit upon him, and he will show judgment to the Gentiles. Verse 19. He will not strive. Slightly different wording there. In the translation from the Greek. He will not strive nor cry, neither shall any man hear his voice in the streets. And that's the point there, that, you know, Jesus was not drawing attention to himself. He told people after he healed them not to noise it abroad to bring him a lot of undue attention. He didn't want it. And that reminded Matthew of this prophecy, that the Messiah was not going to draw attention to himself. He's not going to spread his name out in the streets, as it were. Then he, in verse 20, he continues the quote, and this is the longest quote in the book of Matthew from the Old Testament. He says, a bruised reed shall he not break, and smoking flax will he not quench, till he send forth judgment unto victory. And in his name will the Gentiles trust. Well, this is proof, if you needed it, that that particular prophecy back in Isaiah 42 is messianic. Obviously here Matthew applies it to Jesus. It's very clear. Let's look, if you would, at some of the particular words that are used, just to get a more complete word picture. Perhaps you have a good one already, that's fine. Excuse me. If not, this should help you. If you do have a complete word picture, just bear with me while I begin to paint it with some more details here. In, you know, whether you're looking at Isaiah or Matthew, doesn't matter at this point, but it talks about a bruised reed. The word for bruised just means simply that. It's a reed that's just about broken. I'll read various quotes here. I won't always give the resources I won't identify all the resources where I'm reading from, but if you need to know or want to know, just ask me later. As far as bruised, now this word is translated many different ways in the Old Testament, if you're looking at in Isaiah. It's many times translated oppress, to cause trouble, that is, to cause trouble or hardship or to harass an enemy. It's oppress and oppression and oppressed. It's translated that like that quite a bit. Also, in one form, it's translated break or smash, that is, to make physical impact on an object by hitting it. So a bruised reed is a reed, you know, a plant here, I'll talk about that in a minute, a plant that has been damaged by impact, okay, just like you whack it with a stick. And didn't quite break it off, but it's almost broken. Maybe it's flopped over or whatever. The word has, and it also in some cases is translated like being smashed. And I'll cite you some examples. For instance, and also sometimes struggle. It's translated all kinds of different ways. But you get the idea. We're talking about some kind of a struggle, some kind of an impact, some way that it's been, something has been broken. In fact, in Genesis 25, we don't need to turn to any of these. The children the twins struggled, Jacob and Esau struggled within their mother, Rebekah. That struggling is the same word, like the broken reed, or the bruised reed, I'm sorry. In Judges, it talks about the children of Israel were afflicted and crushed. 1 year, they were physically, crushed. They were impacted by the occupying powers. In the books of Kings, it talks about relying on Egypt and calls Egypt a crushed reed. Now, what does that mean? A crushed reed? Again, you've got a plant, a very stiff and a large plant. Reeds can grow very tall, and seems to be very strong. But if it's been bruised, if you whacked it with a stick so that it had a bruised spot on it, it's not going to be strong. You lean on it, it's going to break. It's going to fall over. And that's the point of several of the scriptures in the Kings and I think Chronicles or also in Isaiah, where it talks about Egypt being a bruised reed. Like, it's not something you want to lean on because it's going to break. It's going to break. It's not strong at all. So that's what we're talking about when we say a bruised reed. Now, a reed itself is of course, it's a word that can be, again, translated in a lot of different ways, but it refers to a reed. You know what a reed's like, those kind of plants that grow in the swamps, and they can get very, very tall, and they have the plume there. That's pretty. It's also translated stalk, or sometimes a reed like a yardstick. A lot of Old Testament scriptures that refer to things being measured, talking about using a reed. In other words, a straight, strong stick. But this particular, in this particular instance, we're talking about the actual plant, the reed, and we're saying it's a bruised reed. Now, if I can read another resource here, talking about the bruised reed itself, both words together. Now behold you, now these are the quotes from Isaiah and also from Kings. Behold you rely on the staff of this crushed reed, even on Egypt, which if a man leans, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is the Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, to all that rely on him. And then it's repeated again in Isaiah. Talking, if you were to lean on a reed, these are strong enough, you say the point is it would break off, and then the sharp part as it broke off could actually pierce your hand. And of course, there's a reason for using that analogy in those prophecies, which we don't need to go into. Here it says, Egypt is called a bruised reed, an undependable, weak staff. God pronounces judgment on Egypt because she boasted of herself and made power and weaned Israel away from trusting him. When the test came, Egypt proved to be a weak support, that is, a bruised reed, and thus caused Israel to suffer pain. When the Messiah comes, he will gently lead his flock, not setting on them more than they can bear. The Lord's servant will establish justice even on a bruised reed. And here they're saying it could refer to the poor of society or even Egypt itself. There'll be justice for Egypt as well. This expectation found fulfillment in Jesus' healing of the crippled man who was truly a broken reed in the synagogue on the Sabbath day. So here this particular resource is saying this is why Matthew was reminded of this prophecy, because the people that Jesus cared for, and we'll go more into that later, the people that he cared for were in some very real ways bruised reeds. They were suffering. They were damaged. They were all but broken in many cases. The prophecy of the Messiah says that the bruised reed he will not break. Well, the word for break just means to break. I mean, it talks about breaking or destroying. In other words, you've got a reed, you've got this reed that's already damaged, it's all but broken. Jesus has prophesied not to break it. It's just ready to be broken. It's just almost there. And so the word for break could also be translated destroy, or it could be translated all kinds of other ways. But the point is, he would not complete the destruction of the reed. He would not complete the breaking of it. He would be that careful. And then we also read that it says now, I want to read it. I'll read it from Matthew. I'm not back in Isaiah. But in the King James, it says, the smoking flax he will not quench. Now, what does that mean? And maybe you already know. I would think about, oh, you've got some grass somehow that's on fire. That's not what it's talking about at all. The words actually mean something else. Now, how about flax in the first place? Flax is a plant. You know that. Flax is the plant that linen comes from, just like cotton comes from a cotton plant. But there's a word that could have been put there for flax. in Isaiah that wasn't. We're just talking about the plant itself. That is the short plant that has a pretty blue flower and from which they make linen. This particular word is put for the lamp wick. They made wicks, just like they make rope. Okay? Made wicks of flax. So you picture a wick in a lampstand. You know, they got oil, you got oil in some kind of a reservoir, and you put a wick in there. And, you know, you've seen candles or lamps that are just flickering. They're about ready to go out. You ever been to a, not mean to bother you here when you plan your wedding, but you have candles at your wedding? I've been to wedding. You ever been to a wedding where, you know, the guys come out and they light the candles? And that's all that's going on. So everybody's watching the candles. And then they can't get one lit, doesn't want to light. Finally, he gets it light, lit, or he's got to go over and get another light from the other guy who's lighting the other side. And they get it lit. But it's flickering. You just, you know, even though there's a wedding going on, you know, I don't know about you, but I tend to be distracted by this kind of thing. And I'm just looking at this candle. Like, is it going to go out? Is it going to make it, or is it going to go out? Some of you look at each other. Did you have candles go out at your wedding? I don't know. I was at one wedding where a bunch of them went out. I think there must have been a breeze or the air conditioner came on. I don't know. But you know how it is when you're watching a candle and it's almost out and you just kind of, you know, it won't take much. It's flickering. It's almost out. And that's the picture here in Isaiah and in Matthew. That you've got a lampstand. You've got a wick that's almost out. It's for some reason, you know, it's a bad wick or it's out of oil or the oil's overtaken the wick, whatever. For some reason, it's just about out. And the prophecy is the Messiah is going to be the type of person who's not going to extinguish it. It's almost out, but it's not out. And it's smoldering, you might say. It's a word that has to do with the presence of fire where you've got some smoke coming off and it's obviously a little warm, but there's no flame. There's no open flame. So the wick is not even just flickering. It's just barely a glow there. That's what the word picture here is to be. It's a smoldering but not burning wick. Let's see if I had some more here I wanted to read about that. They call it a bundle of linen fibers for burning in oil lamps. That's what they used to use. This word for smoldering, it also is translated faded. It means something that's on its way out. It can talk about an older person becoming weak. As they become older, that's one of the ways, you know, diminishing faculties and so forth. Dimming eyesight, the word's translated dim a lot of times, where somebody loses their eyesight. That's another way it's translated. Here's one source that explains it completely. Lamp wicks were made of linen, and the allusion is to a wick that is burning with a feeble flame, from lack of oil and is about to expire. The ease with which the flame of such a wick can be put out is referred to in Isaiah 43:17. They lay there never to rise again, extinguished, snuffed out like a wick. You know, it's easy to put out a candle or a wick, especially one that's almost out already. So this is the picture here, that you have a wick that's almost out. It's not burning, doesn't have a flame. But again, the prophecy of the Messiah is that he won't quench that. That he's so gentle and so careful that he won't even quench a wick that's about to go out anyway. Now, that word for quench just means to extinguish. It's the same word. You could use the word extinguish for it if you want to. Snuff out, you could say with a snuff. You won't snuff it out like you have a little candle snuffer or a wick snuffer. So here again, you have a picture. Jesus will be the type of person that won't break an almost broken reed. He won't snuff out an almost already extinguished flame. That's another part of Jesus' character. We know he was bold. We know he was confident. But yet, he had this side to him too. And we can learn from that. If you're still in Matthew 12, where I am, you'll notice also that in the New Testament, when Matthew quoted this, he quoted something a little bit differently than we have it translated in from the Hebrew in Isaiah. In verse 19, he says, "He will not strive nor cry, neither shall any man hear his voice in the streets." He will not strive. Now, when you can read, at least in my translation here, you don't see that in Isaiah. It says he won't cry. He won't put his name in the streets. But here in the New Testament, at least in the King James, it says that Jesus would not strive. he would not strive. And that word is only appears one time in the New Testament. It's translated strive. And it's used to describe the calm temper of Jesus in contrast with the vehemence of the Jewish doctors wrangling together about tenets and practices. And this is interesting, and we'll look into it a little bit more later. It's interesting, I think, anyway, because of how it portrays Jesus. And let me just look at one other place at the beginning here. The word for cry is interesting. I just want to point this out, where it says he will neither strive nor cry. That word for cry is the same word. It's a, what's the word for that? Is it onomatopoeia, when you have a word that sounds like what it means? If you could speak Greek, this word for cry out is kind of like croak. You know, it's one of those kind of words that has to do with making a cry like a raven, you know, drawing attention to yourself. So Jesus would not be that way. So we have a portrait of a gentleman who's to be known for building up and encouraging those that are most likely to break. You would think, well, you know, a broken reed, a bruised reed, that's something that's just ready to break. And yet we have a picture here of somebody who would build up and encourage someone in that situation. That a flame is ready to go out, not even a flame, just smoldering, ready to go out. That Jesus is painted as the picture of him from the Old Testament is someone who would not extinguish that slight little bit of smoldering. So this is somebody who's different. Now, he's not the bull in the china shop, you might say. Now, I'll read quite a bit here. Well, about a paragraph or two. I do want to identify, if I can. This is from the Gospel of Matthew, Volume 2. It's Barclay, the Barclay Study Bible. This is Barclay's description of Jesus here. He will not strive nor cry aloud, nor will anyone hear his voice in the streets. The word that is used for cry aloud is the word that is used for the barking of a dog or the croaking of a raven or the bawling of a drunken man and so forth. It means that Jesus would not brawl with men. We know all about the quarrels of conflicting parties in which each tries to shout the other down. The hatred of theologians is one of the tragedies of the Christian church. We know about the oppositions of politicians and ideologies. In Jesus, there is the quiet, strong serenity of one who seeks to conquer by love and not by strife or words. And he also talks about the reed and the wick. He will not break the crushed reed nor quench the smoking wick. The reed may be bruised and hardly able to stand erect. The wick may be weak and the light may be out all but a flicker. A man's witness may be shaky and weak. The light of his way may be but a flicker and not a flame. But Jesus did not come to discourage, but to encourage. He did not come to treat the weak with contempt, but with understanding. He did not come to extinguish the weak flame, but to nurse it back to a clearer and a stronger light. The most precious thing about Jesus, according to Barclay here, is the fact that he is not the great discourager, but the great encourager. He's not a discourager, but an encourager. Now, I agree with Barclay's assessment. That's why I read that. Our Messiah is somebody who was very encouraging. He was uplifting. He was not quarrelsome. The prophecy says he's not going to cry out. He's not going to strive, as we read in Matthew. He's not going to break those that are almost broken already. He's not going to complete it. He's actually going to help them. So let's take a few minutes and look at Matthew's gospel in particular to see how Jesus fulfilled some of these prophecies. And he set an example for us as well. Now I'm going to start in Matthew chapter 5. We're not going to read the whole book, of course. I just want to pull out a few verses and show that Jesus had a side to him that we would do, you know, every side of Jesus we would do well to emulate. But here's one perhaps that some of us, I can speak for myself, have not emulated. You know, as we get older, sometimes we get better in these things. When we're younger, I look at myself. I have certain people that I have to deal with that in some ways they just remind me of myself 25 years ago or 30 years ago. And I think, oh boy, you know, I must have been really annoying to people back then. And I think I'm probably annoying now, but I must have been really annoying back then. When I see other people, I think, oh, that, you know, and I try to be merciful because I realize, well, that's just like, I was like that. And so you learn as you get older, but we're to learn as Christians. And if you're younger and you have some of these traits, then somebody giving a sermon about this might be able to be helpful to point to Jesus' example, because we can point to Jesus doing some very bold and brave and maybe outlandish things, like going into the temple and kicking out the money changers. And yeah, that's my man. But there were other times when Jesus was not like that at all. It just depended on the circumstance and what was needed. When it came to dealing with people, came to dealing with weak and needy people, which is what we all are and the whole world is, he was very gentle. And that's the point of this prophecy, I think. In Matthew chapter 5, let's look at verse 38. Of course, this is the Sermon on the Mount, as we call it now. Excuse me. He said, you have heard that it's been said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. He's talking about how you respond in kind. But he said in verse 9 that you don't resist evil. But if he smites you on your right cheek, turn the other also. I referred to this in the Sermon on Boldness. So there's obviously a time to do this. Skipping down to verse 41, if somebody compels you to go a mile, go with him too. Give to him that asks you, and from him who would borrow of you, turn not away. You've heard, verse 43, that it's been said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. That's the way people thought it should be. See, obviously, an enemy is somebody you should hate. But he says, this is what Jesus said. He said, I say to you, love your enemies and bless them who curse you. Do good to them that hate you and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. So here's a new thing, I think. I don't read this, at least it's not predominant in the Old Testament. You know, the Israelites and even their descendants in the Jews in Israel, they still have that same approach. And people in general have that same approach that, if you treat me a certain way, I'll treat you that way back. The Israelis are famous for that. The tit for tat over there hasn't gotten them anywhere. There's no peace there. And Jesus says, as Christians, we need to do good to those who persecute us. We need to love our enemies. Now, that's difficult, isn't it? That's really, in one phrase, sums up what it means to be a Christian, to actually love those who hate you. That's different. Now, why is it different, and why do we have to be that way? Well, he explains that in verse 45. He says that you may be the children of your Father, which is in heaven. For he makes the sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the just and the unjust. God the Father loves all of mankind. And he's going to bring his truth and open up people's minds so that they will understand his truth. But in the meantime, he's not punishing all the people that curse him. He's not saying it's not going to rain on you because you don't believe in me. And I'm going to curse you because you despitefully use other people, whatever. God is not. There is judgment. There's righteous judgment, but he's not that way now. He gives man all kinds of time to learn. And he's very merciful. And we're to be like him. So Jesus is saying here, as in Matthew quotes him, as saying, you need to learn to love your enemies. You need to learn to be good to the people that actually treat you badly. That's hard. That takes God's Spirit. That takes being Christian to do. Chapter 8 is an interesting chapter. There's all kinds of healings. There's a casting out of demons all the way through. I'll just read a few verses. Verse 2, a leper came, and in verse 3, he held out his hand and he was cleansed. In verse 4, that should be verse 4, he told him not to tell anybody. Once again, Jesus was keeping a low profile for several reasons, but he was prophesied to do that as well. Verse 13, the centurion who said, you don't need to come to my house. All you need to do is give the command. I understand it'll be carried out. And Jesus was amazed at his faith. And the centurion's servant was healed that same hour, it says in verse 13. Verse 15 talks about Peter's wife's mother, Peter's mother-in-law, who was healed. She'd been sick of a fever. Verse 16, many that were possessed with demons, he cast out the spirits and healed all those that were sick. This is what Jesus was doing. He was healing. He was casting out demons all the time. Chapter 9, just skipping down to chapter 9, verse 9. Jesus passed forth from thence. He saw a man named Matthew. All right, Matthew's, so he's got some information that happened before he was really active as an active disciple. And he was a tax collector, as he goes in verse 9, explains. And so Jesus was talking to him and had called him. And And Jesus got a lot of criticism for that. And the Pharisees saw it and said to the disciples, why does your master eat with publicans and sinners? In verse 11. Now we'll look at verse 12, and of course we've been through this. Jesus heard that and said, they that be whole need not a physician, but they that are sick. But you go and learn what it means, I will have mercy and not sacrifice, for I am not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. So Jesus was pointing out to others, and it should be our approach as well, that it's not the people that are well that need a doctor, it's people that are sick. That our mission is to bring the gospel to those that need it, those that are sinners. Right? We're not to argue with the righteous people. And that's what we'll see as you go through here. We're not going to read everything, but it's good. When you read through the Gospels, you see on occasion when it was necessary, Jesus answered the Pharisees, and he even took them on there in Matthew 23 when it was time to tell them a few things about themselves. But he didn't go into endless arguments with them to try to prove he was right. He just, we'll read a little later specifically, he just walked away from it sometimes. Why? Well, because they weren't listening. He realized his ministry was to those who were hurting, those who were the sinners, not to these righteous people who weren't listening to him, quote-unquote righteous, self-righteous people who weren't listening to him anyway. He wouldn't get anywhere with them, and he didn't waste his time trying to argue with them. Because why? Because it was prophesied, and Matthew quotes it, that he wouldn't strive. He wouldn't be quarrelsome. But it's natural for some of us. I've raised my hand here. My dad said, you're going to be a Philadelphia lawyer, whatever that meant, it's an expression people used to say. But it's because I can quibble and argue about little particulars, I guess. And he didn't appreciate that. But it was part of my nature, part of my character that I'm trying to overcome, but it's still part of me. And that's not the way Jesus was. Jesus was perfect. Jesus had perfect knowledge. He could have out-argued anybody should he have chosen to do so. He didn't choose to do that. It's not how he operated. In verse 22 of Matthew chapter 9, here's somebody that just thought if she would just touch his garment, she would be whole. And then Jesus did heal her. She was healed. So this was all the time. I can't say it was an everyday occurrence. We don't know. But it happened very, very frequently. Jesus was known for healing people and for casting out demons. In verse 25, here he resurrected Jairus' daughter, or however you say it. I'm not sure how you say that, his name. But he resurrected. And notice it's interesting, too. The expression we have in English, you know, they laugh into scorn, is right here from the King James. Jesus at times did things and said things that opened himself up to ridicule. But he's big enough to take that. He had big, broad shoulders. And he could handle that. They laughed into scorn because he said, well, she's not dead, she just sleeps. And then he resurrected her. I guess they stopped laughing then. It doesn't really say that, but I assume they did. But his approach was to encourage and to uplift. In verse 27, Jesus departed. Two blind men followed him and wanted him to have mercy on them. And then in verse 29, they were healed. And the straightway, it says, their eyes were open. Verse 30, Jesus straightly charged them, saying, see that no man know it. So he's still not trying to, you know, publicize his works. But of course, the fame did spread across the country, it says in verse 31. In verse 33, he cast out a demon, which allowed someone who had been dumb to speak. Verse 35, Jesus went about all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and preaching the gospel of the kingdom, healing every sickness and every disease among the people. This is characteristic of what he was doing. But when he saw the multitudes, verse 36, he was moved with compassion on them because they fainted and were scattered abroad as sheep having no shepherd. Fainted as similar to the wick that was flickering and almost extinguished. You know, he had compassion on them because they were that way. He certainly wasn't going to make them closer to being extinguished. He was encouraging them and giving to them. He was moved with compassion because his motivation was love. Now, you know, we talked about being bold the other week, and you can grab your what do they call that thing, a mace or whatever, like the Norsemen used to use or whatever. You have a big club with all the studs on it and everything. And you can be bold. You can go in and, you know, be a bull in a china shop. But that's not the way Jesus was. And we'll see a little later here how he can be bold and meek at the same time. Verse 35, 36, he was moved with compassion, as I read before. And then he said, verse 37, a scripture we're familiar with, then he said unto his disciples, the harvest is truly plenteous, but the laborers are few. Pray therefore the Lord of the harvest that he will send forth laborers into the harvest. Because people need the truth that's in this book. And part of our job is to be involved in bringing them that truth. Now notice in chapter 10, here's what I was referring to as far as there's some instruction on how to be both bold and gentle at the same time. In chapter 10, and verse, well, it talks about how he had chosen his disciples. And it said, verse 4 or 5, these 12 Jesus sent forth and commanded them, saying, go not into the way of the Gentiles, into the cities of the Samaritans, don't go, but rather, in verse 6, go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And as you go, preach, saying, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Heal the sick, cleanse the lepers, raise the dead, cast out demons. Freely you have received, freely give. And he goes into instructions about how to go about this. And notice that he said, you know, that some people aren't going to listen in verse 14 and 15. And then he says in verse 16, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be you therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves. And we have all heard that expression. But beware of men, for they will deliver you up to the councils. They will scourge you in their synagogues. So this is a prophecy of what was going to happen to the disciples. And you will be brought before governors and kings for my sake, for a testimony against them and the Gentiles. But when they deliver you up, don't take any, don't worry about it. I'll, you know, the Spirit will help you know what to say and so forth. But notice what he said. Here he's telling them that they have a job to take the gospel to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And they're to be sheep in the midst of wolves. And then he says they're not going to listen. They're going to put you before the councils. They're going to scourge you. They're going to do all this. Now, what kind of sheep were they to be? Again, I've never had sheep. You all have sheep. And the sheep that you all have are, they're sheep in the classic sense that we think of sheep. They all hang together. They kind of want to get, nobody wants to take the lead and explore. They're not that way, are they, or are they? One is, okay, there are some, right? So rams will have a little more oomph to them. Okay. So. So some sheep, that is the rams at least, have some initiative and some boldness about them. If Jesus is telling the disciples to be sheep, that gives you a certain picture. But then he's telling them all these things that are going to happen to them. Now, if they were sheep in the classic sense that we think, well, if you're told to be a sheep, you're told to just you know, get in line and follow somebody, right, and do what they say. Is that what Jesus was telling these individuals here? He's telling them to go ahead, and they had to stick their noses in places where they weren't going to be welcome. They were going to be put before councils. They were going to be taken before governors. When I read this, it's saying you need to be sheep. That is, you need to be kind of harmless. But at the same time, they had to be very bold in order to do what he was telling them to do. They had to be bold sheep. Now that can sound like a contradiction. I said the oxymoron before. I meant onomatopoeia. That's the right word for it. The croak word. But anyway, it sounds like an oxymoron to say a bold sheep. But that's what Jesus is expecting here. It's not an opposite. You can be. Maybe we have to be more like rams in a sense. We have to be sheep in that we can follow, and we follow a shepherd. But there has to be a certain amount of boldness to do the job that Jesus has given us to do. So it's both. Somehow we need to have that boldness, not somehow, through the Spirit of God, we need to have that boldness to go where Jesus tells us to go. At the same time, we need to be sheep-like and gentle where we aren't going to break a bruised reed and we're not going to snuff out a smoldering wick. So I think it takes both. And I see in this scripture right here, when I read here what's expected of the disciples, and yet they're to go out like sheep in the midst of wolves, it doesn't say like wolves in the midst of wolves. Everybody be like sheep. You know, a ram is still different than a wolf. But need to have some boldness, and yet be harmless. Wise as a serpent, but harmless as a dove. So I think that gives, to me, that gives some insight into how it is we can be bold and gentle at the same time. The boldness to do what God asks us to do, to follow the example of our Savior. The gentleness to do it in a way that doesn't hurt people, that's not quarrelsome, that doesn't strive. You know, there's sheep and there's goats. The goats are the ones that are always butting heads. The goats are the ones that are always butting heads. The goats are the ones that are always getting where they don't belong and so forth. That's their nature. We're not to be that way. We're to be like the sheep. But there still needs to be some boldness there. We're going to stop off. We're in chapter 10. How about chapter 12? Now, we were in chapter 12 before. Let's go to verse 19. I want to reread that. He will not strive nor cry. Now, when I read that in the Revised English translation that I have up here, he will not strive, he will not shout, nor will his voice be heard in the streets. He won't strive and shout, it says here. There's another translation I didn't bring, which says he won't be quarrelsome. He won't be quarrelsome. Matthew chapter 14 and verse 14. Jesus had plenty of opportunity to be quarrelsome if he wanted to, but that's not what he did. In fact, I think it's later on. Chapter 14 and verse 14. This is again where Jesus went forth, saw a great multitude, and was moved with compassion toward them and healed their sick. This is again his modus operandi, you could say. This is what he did. What he did best. He had compassion on people. He healed them. He cast out the demons because he cared for them. Now, in chapter 15, I won't read all this, but they were complaining because his disciples didn't go through all the ritual washings, okay? And they had lots of rituals and lots of traditions. And Jesus used one of their own examples. I've talked about it before, where they I believe this is one where they didn't take care of their parents. They had these traditions. Yeah, they would devote money to the temple, and then they didn't have to use that money to take care of their parents, which was what the law told them they needed to do. So they had a way around that, so they could hang on to that money, and then when the parents died, some people say they could get that money back. But in any event, they didn't have to take care of their parents. And somehow that was legal in the system of law they had, but it's certainly against the principles laid down in the law of God. And Jesus used that against them. He said, well, you know, you do this because you'd rather follow your own traditions than the law of God. And notice what happened. So he called the multitude in verse 10. He said, hear and understand. And he's explaining that, look, you know, if you have a little dirt on your hands, it's not going to kill you. You know, you're going to eliminate that. And his disciples said, you know that the Pharisees, verse 12, were offended? You know they're offended at you? They do not like what you're saying, Jesus. And he answered and said, every plant which my Father is, and Heavenly Father is not planted, it will be rooted up. He said, verse 14, leave them alone. They're blind leaders of the blind, and if the blind lead the blind, both will fall into the ditch. He said, leave them alone. Now, that sounds easy. It's not always easy. I mean, he's telling them, don't fight and quarrel. Don't strive with them. And that was his nature. He wasn't going to win. He knew he wasn't going to win an argument with them, so he didn't even bother. Sometimes he'd give them an answer, and it would make them shut up, but they'd get mad. But he wasn't style, let's say, to try to prove that he was right. So, you know how, I can be this way. You're getting a discussion with me. I can argue until I've proven you wrong and I'm right. That's just my nature. That's what I do. I'm trying to not have that be my nature, but that's my nature. And Jesus wasn't that way. He was always right. But he didn't bother arguing with everybody to prove it. That wasn't his, it wasn't necessary. Why? Because he was gentle, you see. He wasn't going to strive and quarrel with men. And here he's advising his disciples, who hadn't learned the lesson yet, and really they never did learn it until they were apostles and they had the Spirit, and even then they still had their moments. But he's telling them, just leave them alone. They don't understand. They're not going to get it. You're not going to win the arguments. You're not going to convince them. I'm adding words here, but that's what he's telling them. Leave them alone. You're not going to get anywhere with them. And that's hard to do sometimes. It's hard to not get that, you know, you want to say your piece and prove you're right. At least that's the way I am. Verse 30, great multitudes came to him, having them, those that were lame, blind, dumb, maimed, and many others, and cast them down at Jesus' feet, and he healed them. That's what Jesus was continually doing. He kind of let his work speak for him. He didn't need to prove himself to the Pharisees. Didn't bother. I guess it must have, you know, because he's a human being, it must have bothered him. It had to bother him, just like it bothers you when somebody laughs at you or says you're wrong or they're out to get you and you're sure you're right and you want to prove it. But Jesus had to walk away. He had to just leave them alone. They don't understand. But it still had to bother him. These are his peers. These are the people he grew up with. And they're all making fun of him and criticizing him. Chapter 18. This is an interesting chapter, I think. There's a lot in here. But, of course, in the beginning of chapter 18, it talks about being like little children. And that's the approach we're to have. He's saying, you know, and little children, with respect to authority now, that's what he's talking about, they don't strive. An infant is not striving with their parents, not trying to explain, you know, to the parents how they are right and the parents are wrong. That happens later. But it doesn't happen when they're little children. And Jesus is saying, be like little children. And then it's beautiful the way it talks about this childlike approach. And then you get to verse 15. It gives the instruction on how to approach your brother when you have difficulties within the body. That's all in the context of being like little children, which I think is interesting. And it's been there all along. And I'm sure you've all noticed that. I just kind of noticed it recently. Like, oh, okay. You know, it's all in the same. It's all in the same context there. Be like little children. Well, what does that mean? Again, when in verse 15, when we're told to go to your brother alone, the context is in the context of being like a little child and not being in a striving and argumentative frame of mind. So anyway, I think that's interesting. You can skip over to chapter 20. And just pulling out some verses here to show how Jesus was, how he operated. What did he say? As bold and as brave and as revolutionary as he was, how did he operate? In chapter 20, and you know what chapter 20 is about, but especially when we get up to verse 25 or so, Jesus called and said to them, you know that the princes, this is Matthew 20, 25, you know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them, and they that are great exercise authority over them. But it should not be so among you. Whosoever will be great among you, let him be your minister or servant, diakonos, like your deacon. And whoever will be chief among you, let him be your servant or slave. That word is doulos, or slave. So if you want to be great, be a servant. If you want to be the greatest, be a slave. Even as the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many. So if you want to talk about servant leadership, there it is. It's defined in four verses. Four verses. Very simple. Extremely simple. And Jesus explains it. And it's how to be a leader. It's to be a servant. And that's how he was. He was the slave of all. The doulos, the bond servant of all. In chapter 26, this, of course, is when leading up to his crucifixion. In verse 51. Just to show you just one last example here from the Gospel of Matthew. And he had been betrayed, and somebody, it was Peter, who's identified elsewhere, drew out a sword and struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. And as you've heard before, he probably wasn't that good of a swordsman that he was trying to cut his ear off, but that's what happened. He cut his ear off. And if you read in Luke 22, you find out Jesus took the ear, put it back on, healed him. And he said, here, he said, put your sword up again in its place, for all they that take the sword will perish with the sword. You know, you live by the sword, you die by the sword, is how we phrase it today. That, again, I think is interesting. You know, Peter was, he partly had a right motivation. I mean, he said, my side's right, he's saying. I've given 3.5 years to this ministry, and you're not going to stop it now. You know, whack, top of zero. And Jesus said, no, it's not like that. It's not going to be about you proving you're right. You have a sword. That's the proof. Might is proof. You know, that's not how it works. So he heals Malchus. So he heals the servant there and puts the ear back on. He says, don't live by the sword or you die by the sword. And that could be a whole sermon there. I just thought about it when I was going through this one. But, you know, in our history, just religious history, our church tradition, so many times we, if things that are born of strife end up dying by strife later on. And that's maybe a good lesson there. But Jesus didn't have the approach of having to prove he was right. In fact, he was ready to be crucified. And he didn't answer. You could go into that too. Or he didn't answer Pilate. Pilate was amazed. You know, he didn't answer. Of course, it was his time. But the point was, he wasn't going to convince Pilate of anything one way or the other. And Peter wasn't going to convince anybody of something one way or the other by cutting somebody's ear off. That doesn't prove anything either. But his motivation, though, although maybe partly right, look, I'm on the right side here, was wrong. Because he wanted to be perceived as being right. Peter did. And, you know, once it was clear that Jesus was going to let himself be killed, they all fled. They all fled him. I didn't read that. But, you know, they weren't going to be around anymore. That was too hard to take. So it's something, again, a Christian is supposed to pray for. We're supposed to pray for our enemies. We're supposed to bless people who despitefully use us. We're supposed to have a different approach to that. And it takes the Spirit of God to do that. And it's all about being so gentle that we don't snuff out the flickering wick and we don't break the bruised reed. Just want to turn to a couple of more scriptures. These are not in the book of Matthew, but just about striving in particular. The Apostle Paul used not the same word for striving, but still is translated in English the same way, in 2 Timothy chapter 2. It's so natural to strive. Why we have strikes, why we have wars. James says, why do you have wars and fightings among you? Well, because we don't have what we think we want to have. 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 24. Well, he's warning, Paul's warning Timothy not to get involved in quarrels about things. And then he says that a servant of the Lord must not be quarrelsome. I'm reading from the Revised English now. Servant of the Lord must not be quarrelsome, King James says, strive. He must be kindly towards all. He should be a good teacher, tolerant, and gentle when he must discipline those who oppose him. And God may then grant them a change of heart and lead them to recognize the truth. Even when there's a time when you have to somehow exert some kind of discipline, and what is discipline? Well, perhaps somebody was causing a problem within the church and had to be put out of the church for a while or whatever, or maybe just corrected. Do it in a very gentle way, not a harsh way. Do it in a gentle way because the purpose is to lead people to repentance and not to be quarrelsome. Paul's telling Timothy, no, don't be known for being quarrelsome. In 1 Timothy, you know, where it talks about the requirements or qualifications that Timothy was to look for when picking pastors or bishops, those who were overseeing the church. 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 3. And it's again in Titus. Again, I'm reading from the Revised English. He must not be given to drink or brawling, but be of a forbearing disposition, avoiding quarrels, and not avaricious. And then in Titus, I'll just read Titus as well, where Paul was writing the same things to Titus in chapter 3 and verse 2. To slander no one, he's talking about a bishop should slander no one to avoid quarrels. So I'm not the type to avoid quarrels. I hope I'm getting to be that way, but I wasn't. It wasn't my nature. But, you know, you read what Jesus said, how he was, what his example was, what the prophecies were of Jesus. He was the type to avoid quarrels. And he was right all the time. And he could have backed anybody into a corner. Occasionally he did when need was there, when it was time to answer a fool according to his folly. But for most of us, we don't get that time very often. And it doesn't make a difference if we do. We're going to be gentle. Jesus was bold and confident. He upbraided the scribes and Pharisees for their hypocrisy. He drove the money changers from the temple. But to the average Joe, or Joachim, or Shimon, or whatever their names were, where he lived, he was the encouragement they needed to keep going when things looked down, when things looked bad. He was the one who healed them, and the one who healed their friends and cast demons out of their friends and relatives. He was the one who had compassion on the crowds. Well, he also is our example. He was not quarrelsome. He was so gentle that he didn't break the already bruised and almost broken reed. He was so gentle and caring and considerate and empathetic that he did not extinguish the flickering wick that was almost out already. Let's follow his example. Let's be known for doing right, not debating about what's right, not arguing about what's right. Let's be sources of encouragement, not discouragement. Let's be examples of servant leadership, not Gentile leadership. Let's be sheep in the midst of wolves, confident yet gentle. Let it be said of us that we didn't quarrel, and the bruised reed we didn't break, and the flickering wick we didn't snuff out.